This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Thank you for your practice here this morning and welcome to Jikoji. How many of you is this your first time here? Welcome. Welcome. And thank you to those of you who keep coming back for this quiet stillness. My name is Nen Zen, N-E-N, Zen, Z-E-N, and I am the abiding teacher here. This is my co-teacher, Ocean Sensei, and we're very happy to have spent the last week in Sesshin. Sesshin is a week-long retreat, and we had some of the people who were here for this whole week are still here. We had a week in silence, in a deep opportunity to sit and face ourselves and life, facing these walls from very early in the morning until the late evening, moving as one body most of that time. And it was really a delightful sesshin. Ocean Sensei and I, and Misha Sensei, who couldn't be with us today, but she's right there in our hearts. We three taught it together, which was especially delightful to share the Dharma.
Yes, sesshin practice is a very special time. This center, we do four of these retreats, these meditation intensives every year. And a really lovely opportunity to go a little deeper. I like to think of sesshin almost as if it's almost like one held moment that I'm trying to expand throughout a whole week. Like a concentrated offering of time and of effort. And it's a misconception that we come to do sesshin practice to escape our lives, or to run away. But in fact, the opposite is true. We actually are trying to meet ourselves, meet our very lives with greater clarity. So why do we do it? I think first and foremost, we do sesshin practice because our minds are very noisy. That's why we do it. Because our daily life maybe makes us feel like our attention is fragmented across many different situations or devices or obligations, or that our energy is fractured across many versions of ourselves or stories we have about ourselves. So sesshin gives us this opportunity to offer our main simple conditions for our practice. Silence, posture, breath, simple meals that we take in community together. And all of this is just to facilitate our attention settling. And when our attention settles, we begin to notice the patterns, the shapes of our responses in our life. The reflexes we have of grasping and clinging, of aversion, of self-centeredness. And second, I think Sishin offers us this depth. All of these sitting periods are the same. But having this extended, uninterrupted practice, I feel can show us really what sitting practice is, what meditation is. It's in the steadiness of Sesshin practice, in turning ourselves over to the schedule, that our habit energy reveals itself more clearly. I'm speaking from experience. And I think even more crucially, we see that habit energy begin to soften a little bit. Because we have that support of the steadiness of the Sesshin container. And then it feels like to me that insight and compassion arise not as ideals, or just ideas or concepts, but rather as living qualities of me, living qualities of my attention. Usually for me, the first step is freeing it from my reactivity. So we're held by this container of Sesshin, and we don't have to react. And in a lot of places, we can't react. We just have to be still and silent. And so then our only choice is then to meet that moment with our entire attention, with our entire selves. And I think the third aim, maybe, if I may be so bold, of Sesshin is that practicing together gives us some courage. All of these other bodies and minds, hearts, and breathing all committed the same way we are. Holding this container together that we are making. And it's through this field of awareness, through all of this discipline and intimacy that we experience, that I really feel that change is possible. So we do Sesshin to see more clearly, to let our heart mind wake up to itself. With a little more presence and a little more care. Just a little more presence. It's this really big, dramatic, grand invitation just to a little more presence and a little more care. Because that's what matters. So, one of the great themes of this particular session is the gathering and transmitting of light. And so, Tenkoe, as transmission of light. So we've been playing with this as a theme of our teachings and of our learning all week. And we've been trying to remind ourselves that this light is not some kind of mystical thing that's outside of us, but rather it's clarity, it's warmth, it's compassion, which are all already present in every moment. And Sesshin gives us the opportunity, just like every sitting period, every breath gives us the opportunity to stop our attention from scattering all around and just to attend to what's here, what's true. So gathering the light, of course, means first turning that light towards what's here. And so a lot of you that joined me for beginning meditation instruction this morning, it's really great to work with you and get to meet you and hear about your life and your practice a little bit. We learn that the first step is to turn our attention towards our breath sometimes, or this moment, or this body, or what's happening here. Even if we're turning our attention to the sense of difficulty or the sense of ease. And I feel that it's in turning this way towards that light that we allow ourselves to wake up to what is pushing it away. And again, it's a light that's not meant to be collected or hoarded for us. The other half of the theme is expressing this light and transmitting that light. Letting the care and clarity that arise in our practice move outward into our lives through speech and action and our presence. So we feel when our attention starts to steady, kindness often just flows naturally. That when our heart is settled, when our mind is clear, then our speech becomes more clear. That service and stewardship naturally follows. But another thing we looked at is how expressing the light often means just listening fully to one another. Without calculation, without preparation, just learning to speak and to listen with honesty and clarity and intention. So then I felt like this Sesshin became like a little apprenticeship in both this kind of compassion training and this radical ways of being, but really an apprenticeship to my own life. And an apprenticeship, concentration, and training to let it shine. First, maybe just in a dark corner of my mind, a little corner of my heart. But then slowly we can feel that light and begin to recognize that light shining all around the room. Realize how we are that lamp, and that our light shining, that steadiness, helps each other. and that together we can actually amplify each other's light. So that is my hope. That was my hope for this week, for myself, and my hope for all of you today, is that that light continues to be sensed and expressed.
Ahuti, I have a cup of water I can share with you.
Would you like some water?
Well, as Ocean mentioned this week, we talked about the transmission of light. And you have to sit and very still and be very patient with yourself and be very forgiving of what emerges as you sit very still and very patiently. We find we have to resolve over and over and over again from early in the morning until late at night to let this compassion of which Ocean Sensei speaks bloom as we face all the little things that we have not wanted to look at tend to emerge from the dark corners of our lives when all the other distractions have been put away, all the other devices, all the other busyness of our life. And when you sit still long enough and patiently enough, one cannot help but see that we are the architects of our own suffering. It's nothing out there. It's right here. The origin of our suffering is here. It's this one who has to peel away the layers of self and all of our habitual responses, which Ocean just referenced, so that you can see all of those masks and let them fall away, fall away, fall away. And connect to your light. So we spent this week looking at that light and all of its shadows. Light includes shadow. Shadow includes light. We just chanted that this morning. And when you sit like this, with this courageous dedication to facing what's going to come out in that wall, in the shadow and the light, you are bound to encounter some things emerging from what we joked about, the dark kitchen corner, pantry corners, you know, something that you've shoved away. It's way in the dark of a shelf. You don't look at it. But when you sit, these old wounds, regrets, concerns, some things that we feel are too painful even to show to ourselves, they're waiting for us. Not like monsters, like teachers. So Sesshin is where we take the time to address these teachers with a gentle curiosity. Okay, I see you. What do you want to show me? I'm gonna look. Finally, I'll look. Suffering wants to be seen in the light. One of the Buddha's essential teachings, some of you will have heard this story. It's a parable, really, that Buddha taught. It's in the original canon, supposedly came from the Buddha's mouth. It's called the arrow, sometimes called the dart. It's from the Samyutta Nikaya. And it's an example that the Buddha uses to show how we usually deal with our suffering, okay? Because remember that Buddha's first ennobling truth is, if you're alive, you're gonna have some pain in your life. This story, the arrow, talks about what happens, how we typically, habitually respond to this arrow. This is the Buddha speaking. When an untaught worldling, meaning someone who is not familiar with the teachings, an untaught worldling is touched by a painful feeling, bodily, psychologically, he worries and grieves. He laments. He beats his breast. He weeps and is distraught. He thus experiences two kinds of feelings, bodily and mental. It is as if a man were pierced by an arrow or dart, and following that piercing, he is hit by a second arrow. So that person will experience feelings caused by two arrows. In the same way, when a well-taught, noble disciple, all of you, is touched by a painful feeling, he does not sorrow, lament, weep, beat her breast, or become distraught. So she feels one feeling bodily, but not mental, just as if a man were pierced by a dart, but not hit by that second dart. So everyone here has experienced the first dart, right? Unpleasant sensations, emotions, experiences, bodily, psychologically, emotionally. We know that that's a given of being human. There's going to be some grief and loss and pain and hurt. What the Buddha is teaching us with this story of the two arrows, the two darts, is the difference between acknowledging the pain. This is here. I'm feeling it. I cannot stick it far enough in a deep, dark pantry for it not to exist. It wants to be seen. That's the first arrow. And then the reaction to that pain. An uninstructed person tends to add another arrow, another layer of suffering, the second arrow, mental suffering. Usually takes the form of, this should not be happening, right? I don't want this. I don't like this. I liked it better when it was this way. Why can't it be that way? And it's not to berate ourselves that I'm pointing this out. It's perfectly normal. It's in the realm of human experience for want things to be peaceful, to want to be in harmony, to like a particular flavor of ice cream better than another. But if your happiness and life depends upon it being one way, you're going to suffer extra. That's a second arrow. The second arrow is our mental reaction to the first arrow. And the Buddha is teaching us we have a choice. We have agency. We sit sesshin to see what we've done with our first arrow. How many layers we've added on, how many masks we've had to assume to protect ourselves from acknowledging that pain and suffering. When we sit here, we acknowledge what's in those dark corners. We shine our little light in those corners. This two-arrow teaching of the Buddha and Denkwe, the sesshin where we study the transmission of light, they both kind of turn on the same subtle truth, which is that this light of awareness, Ocean tells it, this light of presence, it's never gone. This first arrow, the pain, is not darkness. It is not true darkness. It is not a place without light. Just your awareness of the pain already involves light. When we say darkness, we usually refer to a place without any light, like total obscuring, right? Nothing. Nothing can be visible. But in the Buddhist sense, even in the darkest shadow, that is not a place without light. Pain and our experience are conditions within awareness, within the light, within the whole field of light. So pain, the second arrow, arises within our minds. And it's able to be seen, even when we've hidden it away, even when we've tried not to look. Even confusion knows confusion. Sorrow knows itself as sorrow. The knowing is already light. So even in the depth of our suffering, this prajna, this wisdom, it's already shining a light, because you know you're suffering. There's a light. This is what Dogen would call a luminous mind, clarity. A mind that neither comes nor goes. A light that's always present. So this recognition of suffering can be transformative. Sitting here for a week and facing all of the little parts of yourself that you've not wanted to look at, what we call the shadows, letting them into the light, compassion blooms naturally when you stop trying to deny your own experience. It blooms like a flower. Or as Ocean said, when you feel joy at the release of birds coming out of your chest. Ah. Or in the Japanese, they have a term that I'm in love with right now, komorebi. Komorebi. It's light filtering through the trees. That's the light that's always here. Even when you're ashamed or angry or grieving, it's present. Those experiences are within the light of your awareness. You could even say that those places that you consider the dark places are actually just expressions of light and shadow. The founder of our temple, Kobun Chino Otagawa Roshi, wrote this calligraphy. It's hanging in our community room, usually. I'm careful to put it right side up, because one time I held up calligraphy upside down. It was really embarrassing, because I didn't look at it first. But right side, right? Jiro was kind enough to translate this for those of us who cannot read it. Beautiful calligraphy. It says, right in the midst of life, the joy of discovering beauty. Right in the midst of life. Let's call life light and shadow. That play between light and shadow. Right in the middle of this messy life, the joy right in the middle of our difficult, messy, complicated, noisy, heartbreaking lives. We look up and, boy, it's a beautiful world. Your beautiful faces. That's the light transmitting itself. Your little light. Everyone's little light bouncing back and forth, mirroring off of all of us. The philosopher, psychologist, Holocaust survivor, Viktor Frankl wrote, What is to give light must endure burning. Sitting this sesshin, we have to burn through some material. We have to use this light to illuminate the places that we have not wanted to examine. And this is how we care for ourselves. This is how we tend that light. We fuel that light with the things that we have not wanted to look at. And it increases our light. That little light is the light that's shining when we're happy and also when we're suffering. It's still there. In your heartache, in your ecstasy, there's that little light. In the light filtering through these trees. In the feeling of the birds leaping out of your chest in joy. Also in the places that you don't want to look. There's that light. When you can accept the shadow and the light as one, whole experience, you're completely alive. In this moment, moment by moment by moment, you meet your life as it is. Not the way you think it should be, definitely not the way you predicted it would be. Anybody here's life is exactly how you predicted it? I'd like to see you and talk to you. Not I, not anyone I know. So that's our practice, to notice. And notice and be courageous in our noticing so that you can see how alive and precious your life is. And let every little piece of it illuminate this right now. This right now. It's all we have. Until the next this, right now. So please practice, whether you can come to one of these week-long sesshins, which everyone is frightened of. There are two people who came, at least two this week, who've never sat a full sesshin. That takes courage. But that's the way in, the deep end. And we encourage you to do this. It's four times a year to take the time to take care of all the little dark corners that don't get any attention, and to see what you can do to transform those places into light. So we encourage you to give it a go. The next one is in December. It's called Rohatsu. Ocean Sensei will be teaching, or not talking so much during Rohatsu. It's a really silent meditation, but there will be people here to support you. We encourage you to pay attention in your lives and let compassion guide you, your little light. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. This is a time that we open up for you. You can ask anything. One of my teachers once said, you can ask anything except for a why question. And of course, some smart aleck immediately said, why? And I'll answer it for you right now. The reason we don't really know what to say about why questions is all of experience from the Big Bang, let's say, if we want to start with the Big Bang, but we could start before the Big Bang, all of that brought us to this moment. There's no way that we can tease out a little thread that's got a bell at the bottom and say, well, that's why, ding, 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 ding. It's just too vast, the interconnection of causes and conditions, to be so simplistic. It's this beautiful mess all together. You can try a why, but I'm not sure we'll have a good, skillful response. But any other question goes. Yes.
So I was wondering from the aspect of Zen, or like your experience of practicing Zen, what's the meaning of life?
There's two questions you can ask. Why is that forbidden for life? Next question.
Find out, tell us.
Well, I mean, the way I don't have much difficulty with that. It's this. What's happening right now? You are expressing the meaning. It's not that the meaning comes from outside. You are the force that expresses the meaning. Your existence is expressing life. So what's your name?
Ashley.
What's your Chinese name?
Wenxin.
Wenxin. Wenxin is Wenxining, right? You are actually the embodiment of life. I mean, the miracle of your existence is the meaning of life, and everybody else too. I mean, the chance of you being existing, very small. Isn't that enough? So you make the meaning. And it's really true, practically speaking, too. I'm not just being like, you know, fluffy about it. It's really true practically, because what you're going to take out of this talk today is a different meaning than, what's your name?
Chen.
Chen?
Yes.
Then Chen. And me too. I can listen to the same sutra 100 times and get a little something out of it. So how about if meaning is just this huge, vast field? Could you accept that?
Yes, that answers my question.
But is there more?
I don't know. One of the things that the founder of this temple, Kovan Chino at the Galaroshi, and his picture and altar is behind us in the next room. One of the things he would say is that it's our job is to make a little Buddha with every being that we meet. Sometimes I'm looking for, you know, what's the meaning of all this? And I don't know what to do, or something hits me, I don't know what to do. That's okay. Not knowing is the best place to start. And sometimes if I need to do something, then okay, then I'll just try and make a little Buddha together with you. So when you meet a rock, or a tree, he said, or a rock, or a little insect, doesn't matter. It's your job is to make a little Buddha with it. Mm. So I think that's actually the same answer, isn't it? You know? It's just we bring this meaning forth, we bring it out, we bring it together. And we're making it together, you and I, together, each moment. With this connection and with that beautiful question.
Yeah, I want to just elaborate, because what Ocean Sensei said, I think, is just the most pure, beautiful thing, which is everything is relationship. All of us right now are making this happen. But for you, we would not be here. But for us, you wouldn't have come up that mountain, that scary road. Relationship all the time. That's really important.
And it's, I really love that the Chinese, little story that encountering the Dharma is like a turtle poking its head up in the ocean through a golden ring. And what a strange story, this idea of, in the whole vast ocean, you know, to be able to come up for air. And it just happens to go right through the golden yoke, we call it, or the golden ring. That's how we should encounter, we should treat our lives, especially in the Dharma. How rare it is to encounter the Dharma. So not only that, that we make this meaning together, but wow, how special it is that we get to make this meaning together, we get to do it together.
Yes. Yeah. I'm Cindy.
Hi, Cindy.
I love your Dhamma talk every time. it had such a strong impact on me. And this time, when you mentioned about the darkness with the light always together, happiness with the suffering always together, and the last talk, you were talking about the falling.
About falling.
Falling. Yes. Yeah. So for me, I feel like this my reflection is like everything integrate together. And it's all about your choice. It's about you always have a dark and a light combined together. If you choose to on the dark side, that's one choice. And you choose with the light side, that's one choice. And you're teaching us to choose the light side. That's what I got. Some moments when I hear that, I feel like a kind of a sad and a shaking, like a, wow, is the dark and the light always together, and the suffering and happiness together. So when you are happy, you know next round maybe suffer. But when you suffer, next round will be happy. Sometimes you feel like, wow, it's not I've been taught, not I assumed. But from this several times talk, I get the point. Accept that altogether, not that desperate. You might have a more courage to stand up, not shaking. Mm. Yeah. So that's my reflection.
Mm.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cindy, thank you so much. The thing is that I'm not suggesting you not enjoy the joy. Okay, enjoy the joy. I am suggesting that if you get attached, that you can only be happy with the joy, you're going to not have so much joy. the middle way, the Buddha talks, the middle way, which is there's joy, there's not so much joy, there's joy, there's not so much joy. Can you just be willing to move with the river of whatever is here? And I also appreciate your pointing out this teaching, which I think the Buddha was making very clear with the story of the two arrows. You are not in charge of everything that happened until this moment. Some things a little, but for the most part, there's lots of influences that are unseen, really, in your ancestry, in your DNA, right, that brought you right here. And now you do have to make a choice. You're responsible, but you're not responsible for everything that happened up until now. But now you have a choice. Once you see you have a choice, you get to make something that's wholesome. No harming you, no harming the world. That's your choice. And then you have to let go because you're not in charge of the outcome. It's tough, but that's the way. Make your choice, do your very, very best, and let go. Let go. That's why it's a practice, because you have to kind of be paying attention to what's actually in front of you instead of making up a story about it or causing yourself some more pain. Thank you for your practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm Chen, and first time taking my powers here. I actually have a question. I haven't practiced this one before, and when you said, okay, transforming the dark spot into the light, what's the hardest part in this process for the first time trainer? I mean, seeing the unseen spot is the most difficult part, or things, I seeing those like darkness and put into the light, meaning accept it or let it go. Which one is the most difficult one for the first timer?
I think it's the looking. I don't think it's the seeing. No, I think it's turning our attention towards it. It's the stopping and the turning our attention to it. Sometimes that's the hardest part. But also, I think that's most of our work. It's just stopping and turning our attention towards it. And quite often, even if it's a difficult situation that we still feel we're in the middle of, quite often the answer is in the situation. You know, it's there. So, not struggling with it, not fighting it, but just stopping and paying attention. That's the first step. You know, we say, in the Zen peacemaker tradition, they say, not knowing, bearing witness, loving action. Those are their three tenets. You know, if you meet something with a beginner's mind, with an openness, I don't know. This moment is fresh and alive and it's never happened before. I just have to pay attention. I don't know. So just meet it with a freshness and an aliveness. And then bearing witness, just try and see what's there. What's actually there? Then the third one, loving action. And I often say that one is like the one with, well, how do I do this? How do I embody the great compassion in the world? That's the easy part. The hard part is paying attention, and the hard part is seeing clearly. The compassion will arise quite often very naturally in us. There's a great koan, a great koan about Avalokiteshvara, Guangyin, with all the hands and eyes, to manifest great compassion in the world. And the monks asked the teacher and said, how is it to be with all these hands and eyes? To be like this in the world. And what did the teacher say? He said, it's like adjusting your pillow at night. What? What does that mean, adjusting your pillow at night? It means it's that natural to just take care of what needs to be taken care of. So once our attitude and our seeing is correct, I think it just flows. The problem is we get hit with an arrow. Right? And then instead of going, oh my gosh, I have an arrow. I need medicine. I need help. I need to get this arrow out. What do? You say, where is that archer? Who shot me? Who did that? What color is your bow? What color, what kind of bowstring does he have? How often did, and we go running around looking for another arrow. We have to center ourselves, you know, of course. Yeah.
And why? Why did he shoot me?
Why did you shoot me? Why? I need to know why and what the meaning behind all of this.
Meanwhile,
is.
You're bleeding out.
Yeah. And sometimes we just have to take care of ourselves and the next thing. Really, why? Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter as much. Yeah.
A question that comes up for me when I look at the things I don't want to look at is, who is it? This question is often for me very much paired with, what is it? How is it? And then, wait a minute, who is it? Who is it that suffering this arrow? It's very, for me, it's been a very profound practice to ask that question. Who am I, the one who's identified with this suffering? my own experience is that very high, like 99.9% of the time, the one who's experiencing that suffering is not the one who's sitting here right now. So there are multiple versions of all of us present in this body, right? Not in a woo-woo way, just because we start out as little babies and we grow into whatever this is now. And so I've often tell people, some of you are here this week, know that you have to take care of that one. Take her into your lap and take care of her. It's a simple kind of response to acknowledging that there's a wounded person here. And until you take care of her, she's going to keep hurting. When you take care of her, you'll recognize her the next time. And you'll be faster. Before you do something unskillful, you'll be faster to take care of her. And then you'll be able to respond. As Ocean says, compassion arises very naturally when you have it for yourself. It's just a no-brainer. It just pours out over everybody when you've practiced taking care of the one who's suffering. So you gotta look with a gentle curiosity, with not knowing. Can we do that in our lives? Yeah, we can. Especially it's important when something is bothering you and you're starting to get that, gonna react. Like it's a little animal coming up in you and you're going to go, blah, 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 blah. or any of these options are okay. But in that moment, you can make an effort to take care before you do something that is unskillful towards yourself, before you speak to yourself unskillfully or unkindly. To practice with compassion, it's transformative, actually. And then you walk around the world, and people might even be blaming you and shaming you, and you'd say, "Boy, that person's suffering." Because compassion naturally arises because you can see that person's suffering. Our country is suffering. Our world is suffering. So take care of this one who's suffering, so you can take care of the rest of us. Michael-san.
I was gonna leave it, let it go, but
I could tell.
You actually mentioned the animal. Something I've very much landed with me this week, and it came from little bits of each of your teachings, Misha and Ocean and Yunin, and it that, and I'll try to do the each one, those dark corners, those shadows, those dark things in the corner of your kitchen pantry. I think about just one example of mine. My anger. I can get very angry about all sorts of things. And I have this temper, and it's an angry dog.
Mm.
And my reaction is to kick it and fight it.
Mm.
And battle with it and express it. That's my reaction. But if I am able, and Zazen teaches this, to pause, to have that pause point like you just talked about, Ocean, that stop, and turn my attention towards it and respond with grace and patience and compassion for myself, and pet the dog. I mean, that was such a transformative teaching for me this week that I will never forget. And now, but now back out in the world, you know, taking my Zendo and my teachings to those, to the grocery store aisle, the jerk in front of me and the person in a rush behind me, and practicing that pause, response, compassion for myself, and be present with just what's right in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
So powerful. Grateful for that teaching.
Well, so this was a story that I told last Sunday, which is a teacher, an older teacher of mine, thank you, Koan Sensei, who's passed away now, told this story that his student came up to him and said, everywhere I go, there's stress in my life. I go to work, my boss is haranguing me, you're late, you haven't done this, you haven't done that, and, you know, people don't do what they're supposed to do, the people who are my subordinates, and so much stress, and I go home, and my partner's, you know, just unhappy with this and with that, and, you know, I haven't fixed this, and I haven't done that, and stress, and, you know, everywhere I go, there's stress. And Koan Sensei, I don't know if this happened to him or if his teacher told him, for all I know, and the teacher says to the person who's stressed out, yes, stress is a very loyal dog. Kicking it hasn't seemed to work. Why don't you try petting it? Same thing. Look in the dark places for what is asking for your attention? What needs to be kind of taken up and treated with compassion? And it's not like a once and done thing with anger or with anything else. This is a practice. I'm practicing every day, all the time, with all the little dogs that keep biting at my heels. They're all me. They're my fabrication. Nobody else's dogs. So best take care of them. Give them a milk bone.
Yes, but all anger's not bad, I think. I think you need some righteous anger.
Well, we haven't even talked about right and wrong.
No, this isn't right and wrong. This is righteous anger. This is
anger.
What's going on now? You can't passively sit by and think the next person's going to take care of that.
Mm.
You know, there is righteous anger.
Well, this is an interesting thing, Michael-san, because lately I've been thinking about righteous anger as a very dangerous place. I mean, I agree with you. You know, we agree about how important it is to take action. But righteous anger is tricky. I think maybe what we have to do with our sense of this is wrong and I want to make a difference is get the righteous one out of the way before we go out into the world. In other words, there is an ego involved with a righteous response. Now, it might be a semantic thing about the word righteous. I admit that. I can get very seduced by words. But I really have noticed that when people get very righteous, they think there's one way. And that's tricky. It's really tricky. I think that our capacity to allow multiple views, not knowing, as Ocean Sensei just said, and trying to collaborate to come to something that is better, makes the world better. So righteous anger is like almost the beginning of the inquiry. And then if you take care of the righteous piece, then you can go be wholesome with that force. Coming from a place of anger, I mean, the people that I most admire, Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and millions of other peacemakers, Bernie, they're amazingly powerful people. They were not acting out of righteous anger. They had dealt with their anger first. This might be a bigger conversation we're going to have, I can tell.
Yeah, I don't agree.
Yeah, where can I root my response? And sometimes I'll notice that I've been rooting my reaction, rooting my response in my discomfort, in my anger, in my disappointment with the situation. And I notice that even when it has the intended effect, it doesn't quite have the intended effect. So when I come back and I read it more in like compassion and wisdom, things tend to turn out better in the long run. You know, again, I'm not attached to these outcomes, but I'm aware where I'm rooting my reactions. You know, what is my intentionality here? Yeah, so yeah, anger's a tricky one, and I really want to be angry right now at a lot of things. There's a lot of things that are wrong with the world. There's a lot of things that are on fire, you know. But as somebody so wisely put it in session this week, the world has always been on fire. So, I was watching one of these interviews with somebody who was protesting in a place where there was not many people protesting. They were one of the lone voices out there. You know, and the reporter says, "Do you think what you're doing is really going to change anything?" You know, I was like, what a question. Do you think you really can change the world by standing out here on the corner with your sign? And said, I'm not out here necessarily to change the world, it's so the world doesn't change me. And I was really hit by that. And I felt that this was a person who was not rooting themselves in anger in response. It was so clear as this is what had to be done. This was the only logical, compassionate next step for the world, was to stand here from the hours of whatever to whatever, 2 to 4, and hold my sign so the world knows. And didn't feel angry. And people that came up to her and were ready to fight with her about it, and she, you know, as the expression says, I got no dog in that fight. You know, she wasn't there for a fight. It was impossible to fight with her, right? And she said, hey, do you really think that it's like this? I don't know. Maybe you're right. I don't know. You're right. I just keep holding my sword. How do you argue with somebody like that? Somebody that's willing, how do you argue with somebody who's so willing to listen to you?
Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard. So, where am I rooting my thought? Be on that corner with holding your sign. Be really clear where that signpost is, you know, rooted.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Hi, my name is Jess. So I have a question regarding how we should interact with today's technology, like social media and AI. You know, all these different apps trying to grab our attention. There is definitely instant gratification there, but how should we do the practice of saying no to those on a day-to-day basis?
You're asking two people who really avoid social media.
I think you might be asking the right people, but also the wrong people. Because maybe we both are kind of like, I don't have this figured out. It is a difficult place to engage skillfully sometimes, right? So, do you have something?
Well, it's really not different than any of the other commercial attacks on your integrity that have been going on since, you know, the beginning of money. So if you think about it, you know, people spend inordinate amounts of money on status symbols of all kinds, right? And then they promote it as if it means something, and it's means not has no meaning. They're giving it the value, right? And I guess the way I look at it is, how do you want to spend your precious life? I mean, it's finite, my friend. It's finite. I promise you that. And your lifetime is finite. And how much time do you want to be looking at what other people think and do? And how much time do you want to be alive in the world? I mean, I understand its lure. I love looking at the New York Times recipes. We both do, actually. And I'm sure some of you do. But I discipline myself, basically, not to be in that world as much as this world. That world, at some level, isn't real. But you can jump in and jump out. You know, why not? As long as you can, jump out. You just have to be able to really own your agency. And at some point, I know from having experienced the scrolling feature of myself that it doesn't feel good. Stop it. Just, you have a choice. So for me, I think it's all about your actually being radically responsible for your time being you. And it affects all of us, right? If people, I go to restaurants occasionally, and I'm a little still freaked out. Maybe it's a generational thing by people, you know, friends at a table. I'm like, wait, I want to go talk to each other. I mean, this, you're going to really regret that you did not talk to this friend. Because it's so precious that we even have a friend that we can be completely ourselves with. Or maybe they can't. Maybe that's how they're drugging themselves. Like, I don't want to talk to them. But I would use your time as this incredible, robust opportunity to be alive. That place does not feel alive to me. And I think it's just endless comparison. And basically, I think comparison is, I don't want to say evil, but close.
I like, there's a great idiom that I always, comparison is the thief of joy.
There you go.
It sounds like, makes sense to me.
Right, and we're doing this to ourselves, by the way. You know, if you don't buy it, it doesn't sell. So
it's two arrows.
Right.
We got hit by the first arrow that says, you know, I'm not good enough. And then we'll go and look to social media. You know, that's another arrow usually. I don't usually then put down social media and say, oh, I'm so glad I did that. I feel so much better about myself.
Yeah.
Or about the world. Right? No. No, we talked about that this week as well. We can't turn our back to the world either.
No.
We're not talking about that. I mean, we're aware of what's happening in the world. We're aware of what's happening. But the 24/7 news cycle, the constant comparison. You know, we were even, somebody brought up in one of the circles, you know, just the, you know, in this world we were getting hit by so much advertising and media and influence. This was really intense. I've started reading a little bit about you're familiar with the term the male gaze, right? You know, the idea that you know, men are usually the ones with the cameras. So they were the directors of photography, the directors of the media. So where would we point the camera at was what was getting reproduced and expressed. So it was consciously or unconsciously kind of going through a male gaze. I was reading this paper recently talking about the algorithmic gaze. So we've gone beyond even a human reflection back at us, but just a computer at eliciting and pulling out those little responses from us of comparison, of not good enough, of pleasure, of displeasure, or whatever it is. And it's getting good at it because it's a feedback loop. And the more that we're interacting with it, we're training it, and we're training ourselves, right? So, little things you can do. My partner has a smartphone, but they turn the color saturation way down on their phone. So their phone is basically black and white. So every time they pick up your phone, they get less of a dopamine hit.
Mm-hmm.
It's less pleasurable. I'm still getting the same information, but it's less shiny candy, you know. little things like that, you can kind of, if you have to, for your work, for things, you can engage it in a very, I guess what I'm saying is you can engage it in a very conscientious way. Like Nenzen said, you can, I can look at this for 10, 15 minutes. We like to hop on Instagram and look at the thing, what's going on with the world, New York Times cooking, yeah, I like that. And then I put it down. So that's also a light. There's a lot of darkness in this little machine in my hand. I know that for me personally, for my practice. So a way maybe to reveal that light is by looking at that darkness, you know? Why, when I'm bored, I'm not settled in myself, do I go reaching for things like that, like candy, like things to distract me like that? Why do I do that? Maybe I can make it my practice instead, when I'm feeling like that, begin to notice that feeling and choose something different.
Yes. We should stop there.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.